Welcome back to the Media Movie Club podcast. I am John Kissel, and with me tonight is Shane Settner.
Yo.
And Pierce Bauer.
What's up?
Here at the Media Movie Club, we select three movies available on streaming, available to rent, available in theaters, whatever. Movies in general. It's a dying art form, and we're on a train going to nowhere. And we write reviews of those movies, post them on our website, MediaMovie.club. And then after those three movies have been reviewed, we do one a week. At the end of the month, we get together and discuss them. And the movies that we discussed in this last month, three doozies, each one. Knives Out, I'm Thinking of Ending Things, and The Social Network. Our first movie is Knives Out. This is a chamber murder mystery, detective-type story. What's his name? Poirot, Sherlock Holmes, that kind of deal. This was released last winter in 2019, directed by Rian Johnson. Big hit. Oscar-nominated screenplay. Let's go around the horn, as we always do, with initial thoughts. Shane, what'd you think of Knives Out?
It was fun. It was not as serious as I thought it was going to be. So it kind of threw me off a little bit, but ultimately an enjoyable movie.
At what point did you know it wasn't serious? When Daniel Craig opened his mouth for the first time?
Yes. I mean, I was kind of waiting for it to get kind of serious. Like, okay, there's going to be some kind of, we're going to have a little levity in here, but then when Daniel Craig is completely off the ball, you're like, all right.
Sure, yeah. Pierce, Knives Out?
I think this was like a big win for just genre. Like, the murder mystery genre for me was never something I thought about. It was not something I considered like a genre I enjoyed. But when I saw this originally in theaters, I was enthralled with it, because I thought it was the type of movie I've never really watched before, and so I found it enjoyable.
I mean, these aren't really movies people make anymore, really?
Not really. It's hard for me to come up with a lot of comps. I mean, it's a very small box. They all follow, you know, a pretty familiar format, dating back to, like, Sherlock Holmes novels that I read when I was, like, 12. But, yeah, you've got, like, this and Murder on the Orient Express that we did last year, maybe, with Kenneth Branagh's mustache. That was fine. That wasn't, like, that wasn't breaking the mold by any means, but yeah, I'm more or less where Pierce is. Like, this mystery dramas, murder mysteries, whodunits, they're fine. Like your Clint Eastwood turn of the century movies, Kiss the Girls, Along Came a Spider, like, I don't know, those seem fine. I don't have that strong of feelings about them. Those Sherlock Holmes movies that Guy Ritchie did are fine.
Those other ones, it seems like more of a Seven ripoffs.
Sure, like, yeah. It's not,
like,
yeah.
More like a Clue dinner theater.
Yes, yeah, Clue. And that's another movie that I have never seen, but I feel like that one is, if anyone is going to, like, flip this genre on its head, it's going to be that one, because it's, like, explicitly a comedy. But
a poorly reviewed comedy,
I think, too. It's got a good legacy, I think.
It's
Clue.
It's got a great legacy, but
it's time.
It was poorly
not reviewed. Unlike The Thing from last month.
Right.
Okay, yeah, yeah. I would buy that. But this is a lot of fun. This has an incredible cast. This managed to be about something more than just, like, who killed the old man and who's going to get all his money. And it's a crowd pleaser. I saw this in theaters, not the weekend of release, but maybe a couple weeks after. And I can imagine it would have been a lot of fun to see in a theater. There's a lot of big payoff moments, a lot of surprises. It doesn't just save its big reveal towards the end. There are a lot of little reveals spaced in along the way. It becomes one thing, and then another thing, and then another thing, and then it becomes a thing that you thought it was going to be the entire time at the very end. So, really smart, keeps you guessing, and the best, I feel like the best possible version of this kind of movie. Because again, I don't generally think that strongly of this. I don't have strong feelings about this.
Unlike
murder mystery genre.
Unlike the next movie we're going to talk about, it's just hard to garner too much emotion about this one, right? It's just completely, it's a very well done version of this.
Sure. Yeah. And, like, that's my standard B+, is like, this is the best version of the thing that it is reminding me of. And then to ascend to the next level, it needs that little extra emotional oomph or emotional push.
Yeah.
As you guys are watching this movie, were you just locked in? Was the guardrail down? You're on the roller coaster. You're going with it as it moves along, or are you, like, trying to get ahead of it? making guesses, making assumptions, finding those assumptions flipped. What? Tell me about that, Pierce.
Well, I think you hit on it earlier, which the movie does a smart thing where it doesn't put all its eggs in one basket, right? Like you mentioned that Murder on the Orient Express, which I think pretty explicitly does the opposite, right? Like there's a really big reveal at the end that the mm-hmm. whole movie hinges on. And like you said, like it's like 30 minutes in or towards the end of the first act is when you actually see the death happen and they show it to you. So it's not that it's not like some Motley where it's hidden the whole time and at the very end you're supposed to be wowed by it. There mm-hmm. is like a plot to it where the mystery unfolds in a couple different directions. So I think it works in that regard. And really for me, like when I was watching it, like I said, it was more that I was just taken aback by how refreshing I found the genre to be as kind of a newer thing for me, right? So like going into it, I didn't know it was going to be something I would respond to in that way. But once it was going, I think part of what Rian Johnson does well is making a pretty watchable movie. Whether it's taking big swings or not is not what I'm concerned with as much as it's just like I found it a very enjoyable experience. Not just that I liked the movie, but I found the experience of sitting there in the theater and having it unfold in front of me, that was actually enjoyable.
Yeah, to go off that, like the literal reveals, you don't spend the whole movie just guessing what exactly happened. It's kind of hard to get ahead on this one, whereas some other murder mysteries, you're just trying to constantly guess who it is. And there's some thing like M. Night Shyamalan twist and like, oh, okay, well, you know, how could you possibly have seen that? So it's just an exercise in frustration. Giving me a little bit really lets you enjoy like the filmmaking, I guess. Like all the
sure.
backgrounds are fun, the characters are fun, dialogue.
The house is great. Yeah, the house looks great. The
house is great. Yeah. So
the sweaters are look cozy. like there isn't, to answer my own question, there isn't necessarily so much to catch on to because it tells you who did it. It changes its mind later in the movie. Justify, I don't say that negatively, but it removes the rooting interest of from the detective played by Daniel Craig, Benoit Blanc, and shifts it onto the perpetrator who really did it accidentally, sure, but still did it nonetheless, and you don't want to get caught. So by doing that, it kind of erases and Rian Johnson, we're going to talk about him next, but he's like a director who's very plugged into film criticism and talking about film, and like he shows up on all these film podcasts, which I feel like is a solid career move for him, just because he does make good movies, sure, but if he's friends with / film cast and film spotting, then it's going to be hard for them to like slag on his movie,
right?
And just to plant that seed of like, oh, Ryan's a good guy. But I'm sure he understands that it's easier to make a movie that doesn't have twists in it than one that does, just because there's always going to be some part of your audience that is as smart, if not smarter than you. And like for them, the movie is like ruined.
Right.
As soon as they figure it out. So he treads down that narrow path of like, there are twists in the movie, but none of them are going to like destroy the movie if you figure them out, because there's going to be another one coming that you may have not seen. But speaking of Rian Johnson, not one of my favorite directors, but I think certainly one of the more interesting directors, like Pierce, you mentioned, that he just knows how to make a good movie. He's made five movies and played a pretty key role in Breaking Bad, the look of that show as it went on. And he hasn't made a bad movie yet. A lot of hot-tempered nerds on the internet might disagree about The Last Jedi, but I find it hard to imagine calling that movie bad. But he to me, is someone who, again, has listened to him talk a lot on podcasts about the movies he makes and movies in general. He is a person who thinks about how movies are supposed to go if you're sitting in the audience. And he, like, very consciously makes his movies to try and subvert that expectation. Like Looper is I feel like I talk about Looper a lot, where he understands that people have made the flip charts or the they've got their bulletin boards at home with the string and the text, and they're trying to figure out how Terminator 2's time travel works, or Terminator in general. And he just has his character like, we don't care about that. We explicitly don't want to talk about it. Otherwise, we'll just be drawing on napkins in this diner, and we have no interest in that. And then it makes the movie so much better by absolving you from having to worry about it at all.
Pierce and I were just saying you talk about Looper too much.
I mean, it's a problem.
You're always talking about Looper. It sucked that you couldn't get the actual Looper license vanity plate.
Yeah.
But you were able to go with a capital I-00-P-E-R, so that was good.
Yeah, the people that honk at me are either big Rian Johnson fans or I'm just a bad driver.
It's fine.
It could be either one. It's probably the latter. I did just smoke a median not too long ago, so... He knows what kind of movie he's making, and he knows that he needs to not make the expected thing. Other Rian Johnson movies that this reminds you of, or can you guys see what he's doing? This is probably more directed at Pierce than Shane.
How dare you? But yeah, go ahead, Pierce.
Oh, really? I thought Shane was a huge Brick fan.
strangely enough, he's a Brothers Bloom guy.
Yeah, that's got a guy in a hat.
That's not wrong. You're right. There is that. I think to think about Rian Johnson's like filmography, which is what like Looper is really one I do want to revisit because it's been a while. But what he does best, I think, is one of those. I think of him more as someone like Beck, the musician, right? Like where he's taking on a different genre in each movie, but each one is still like very succinctly his, right? Like he puts his signature on everything he does, whether it's a Star Wars movie or like a noir set within a high school, you know? So like, what I find most fascinating about him is I think he's like you were saying this kind of where he's like a filmmaker's filmmaker in a way, where I think people really respect him more for like his trailblazing within the confines of what have now become like studio movies. And I guess like Last Jedi takes on the biggest amount of that load, right? But like, I don't know. When he puts it to something like this with Knives Out, it's reinventing something I didn't know I needed reinventing, right? So like, I respect that. I respect that trailblazing. I don't know if his movies always sit as well with me as they do with others. Like I didn't love The Last Jedi the way some people think it's this like big subversive, you know, blockbuster. Like I still think there's parts of that movie that are just pretty garbage Star Wars.
Sure, yeah. And as long as we're sidebarring, like I think that's too meta. Like you can hear the conversation that it's having with like Star Wars fans while it's happening. It takes it too far. I like everything it's doing, especially because it's sticking their thumbs in like the eyes of a person who was on Reddit like wondering who Snoke is, what's his backstory, where did he come from?
Which those are the worst parts of that movie is when you have to like I would have loved if he could have just made a Star Wars movie that wasn't part of that trilogy.
Yes. Yeah.
Had no story and it was just garbage. But you know, like if he could just continue to do things like Knives Out or Looper, where he's just doing his own thing, I like that. I'll always sign up for that with Rian Johnson. And you mentioned Breaking Bad too, which is like he just knows how to direct really. Like he like those episodes of Breaking because he did The Fly, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So like that's the type of thing where it's like if you just give him the I don't know the analogy off the top of my head. If you give him the ingredients, he'll make you something good, right? Like if you say, like, hey, give it. This, we're just gonna do a bottle episode with our two main characters where they slowly go crazy. He'll direct the shit out of that, right? If you say like, give us a high school noir or give us a murder mystery in the 21st century, like I enjoy that he makes it his own while still satisfying, like you know, like we'll talk about with the next movie here, but like. There are filmmakers and people who like they can make a movie their own, but it doesn't have that mass appeal. And I think Rian Johnson puts the difference pretty well.
Yeah, that's a solid comparison.
Yeah.
As far as Knives Out spot in this particular place in history, I really like that it's such a strong class satire. I feel like going forward. And in the recent past as well, like the laziest shorthand is going to be, like, I don't know if I imagine Shane did not, but like the dead don't die there's a character wearing a Trump hat in there. So it's just, okay, easy shorthand. I know exactly who this guy is, and the movie doesn't change my mind about it. It has no interest in changing my mind about
it. Is this another Rian Johnson movie?
No, this is a Jim Jarmusch movie, a zombie movie. Zombie movie about people that know they're in a zombie movie. It's annoying as fuck.
No, I was going to say, Rian Johnson really likes movies with guys in hats.
He does. He's a big hat guy, yeah. And in relation to The Dead Don't Die, like Knives Out, it just goes a layer or two or three deeper, that all these like arguments on soft leather furniture in front of a fancy mantle with like staff taking cake plates away. They're welcome to disagree about politics all they want, but they have something ironclad in common that they're going to guard very jealously when someone tries to, in their minds, you know, take it from them, taking quotation marks. And that goes for resistance, goop, liberal types, or wealthy college students. And it goes just as much for like Don Johnson's "I built that" conservative kind of guy.
Yeah.
He's just thinking deeper about what's been happening.
I'd rather watch this 100 times than deal with the way Twitter handles class arguments. I'd watch this for 100 straight days, nonstop, rather than if I could just avoid another lefty. I can mute enough of those guys.
Yeah. And who would want to hear Toni Collette's character go on about whatever? And just the same as who would want to hear that masturbating nerd go on about shitposting? That you can mute them both. They're all terrible, and they're linked by this grotesque flood of money that they never did a single thing to get a hold of. Like the movie's view of like valuable work, I think, is interesting. Like the patriarch, Christopher Plummer's character, who like dreamed all of this up. That's good and valuable, and I think it's like a very conscious decision not to make him in any way a bad guy. Like, he's a good, solid dude.
Yeah, well, and then his kids are fucked up.
Yeah, he like gave him too much. He gave him too much money. But in like the descending order from there, there's the Michael Channing's character who mooches off of him, who like furthers his empire, sure, but he's not actually doing anything.
Yeah,
and Toni Collette's just sheer fraud, and Don Johnson's like leech-like behavior off of his wife, who seems like the most successful of the kids,
right?
But only because she like was given a huge head start with a giant loan. And then below them is like solid professionals who just really know what they're doing, like Benoit Blanc and Marta, who we'll talk about next. And just like competence is what this movie, and I think most like chamber mysteries, have in common, because who's more competent than Sherlock Holmes? Like that's what rises to the top. And so like these movies, and this movie too, like in being about class and like something that transcends class, is competence. Like you can always like you would hope that you would be able to see, and we'll talk about this with The Social Network with the Winklevi. Like you would hope in like the ideal scenario, you would be able to at least see like complacency and laziness in the upper class, just to make you feel better about yourself. If you can manage to be competent, well, at least I have that.
Yeah, the Michael Shannon characters made me think, like, we've had that viral TikTok going around of the Fleetwood Mac dream song, "Guy on the Skateboard." Have you seen this?
It's like an old man.
It's like a young dude, young dude on a longboard, and like, this guy gets, you know, like Twitter and TikTok famous, and then Mick Fleetwood did it and copied it off it because it got so successful.
Did you just make that name up?
That's his name, Mick
Fleetwood. Mick Fleetwood?
Yeah, Mick Fleetwood.
I did not know that.
Fucking drugs in the 1670s.
I did not know that.
And so he does it, and then someone's response I saw, it had like 30,000 likes or some shit. It was like, wow, Ocean Spray, because the guy's drinking cranberry juice.
Yeah.
So everyone's drinking Ocean Spray. Someone's like, wow.
That guy's name is Mick Fleetwood.
Not the guy first.
The Ocean Spray guy.
Mick Fleetwood is in Fleetwood Mac.
Yes.
Okay.
I thought that would be
evident. That makes sense in retrospect, but it kind of adds another layer. If the Ocean Spray's guy, his name was Mick Fleetwood.
Yeah, the guy
who he named a band after himself. I didn't know that.
Mac, yeah.
And, I'm a Fleetwood Mac fan. I had no idea.
The guy who's writing the original, I think his name is like Dogface 420 or something.
Okay.
Anyway, someone's first reaction to Mick Fleetwood doing this just completely organic thing was, wow, Ocean Spray should have gotten this and made it themselves and put them together. And it's like 30,000 like, why? But not everything has to be just diluted.
Sure,
by that.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Just murdered by people like Michael Shannon in this.
Yeah, why it wasn't this semi-pure expression of
just fucking
humor and nonsense?
Yeah.
Why can't it just be that?
Yeah.
Sure. The Ebert Fest that me and Brian went to, we were wearing our Mediocre Movie Club shirts, and we had a guy give us his business cards. Like, he wanted to put us under his web umbrella.
Yeah.
Like, that's not really what we're trying to do, friend.
Yes.
Wait,
why can't people just have
hobbies? What this is about? That's not what we're doing here?
Sorry, you're going to have
to... Yeah, Pierce, your check is in the mail.
Yeah. You're going to have to get rich off your teaching career, pal.
Yeah, that'll happen long before you see a penny from the Mediocre Movie Club. We mentioned Marta for the first time. I've seen this movie twice. The first time I came out of it thinking, like, she was a little too idealized as someone, like, outside of this circle, like a noble sufferer who has had to stomach the bullshit of this family. But on another view, on a second viewing, I don't find that to be the case anymore. I think she's just a competent professional who was recognized by the patriarch, and that deserves a reward in the same way that just birthright previously deserved a reward. Like, he just changed his mind late in life. He's been funding his useless family for so long. They didn't do anything to get all this money, and she's doing something. So it just makes more sense for her to be an average person that gets all this light shown upon them. Now, is all this money going to ruin her now? And there's going to be a sequel to this movie. It's not going to be a sequel necessarily. It's going to be a Benoit Blanc chronicle. But if we ran into her again, is she going to be like, is she going to have like a little purse dog? And
well, I mean, it always seems like in real life, and maybe this, I don't remember how famous this, the patriarch got, how young he was, but it always seems like there's a correlation with how old were you when you got successful as a movie star or a rock star.
Sure.
And the older you are, the more grounded you tend to be. So she's already lived a life.
Yeah. And I have so much respect for like the final twist of her. I mean, if you ask me to like write out the flow chart of who switched the vials when and what label is on the vials, I probably couldn't do that. But I just really like that the final determination is her just intrinsically knowing the viscosity of one drug versus the other. Fantastic. I love me some good competence porn. And that's just like a pure distillation of it. Pierce, Marta works for you. That doesn't like raise an eyebrow.
Yeah, I mean, she works, I think, for a couple of reasons, right? Like, she... I get what you're saying, where that character could become the, like, it's almost too assumed that we should be overly sympathetic for her, I guess. But
mm-hmm.
In part, the treatment of the character is done well, where we get, like you said, I think the relationship between her and Christopher Plummer is like what we get to see of them together before he dies is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the like stuff we get to see of her life. And I think it goes like on multiple layers, like even just like the way she dresses, her home life, we get to see her home, like giving the character that amount of time and that like detail really helps. And then I also think Ana de Armas is very good in the role and is a name who like, I didn't know her name before this movie, but I'd probably seen things with her in it. But now she's like top of the radar. Like, I know she's going to be the Bond girl whenever that comes out, but that like,
oh yeah.
Yeah. She's like, I'm excited to see what she does next, 'cause I think she delivers a very genuine performance in this role that also helps kind of, you know, push it past that line of feeling too sappy, right?
Yeah.
Or too cheesy. And it does feel genuine in a movie full of very caricature-esque like performances, which are good, I still think. Like, I think they work for the other characters, but I think she grounds that character and that performance so it flows within the movie.
Yeah, she's a normal person in abnormal circumstances, which is always, you know, solid audience surrogate territory. The last thing I'll say about Knives Out is that there's not enough Will readings in movies. Like, I feel like it's an obvious source of, like, drama and tension and comeuppance and catharsis. And I don't know, I'll eventually go to one in my real life, I would imagine. I'm going to be pretty let down, probably.
You want a Will reading?
Sure, yeah.
I will put it in my will that they have to have a Will reading, so... I die.
And it has
everybody gets or debt. Or congratulations, everyone. Here's a slice.
Yeah.
In this joke, Shane dies in the next 5 years. Yes. So yeah. We'll revisit. We'll still be doing this through then, certainly.
And he'll still be alive.
Just give like 50% to him. He'll figure out a way. He's a striver.
The will reading has to be like part of the trio. Like, we do the will reading, but then we also do, like, two shitty movies.
You know? Solid, yeah. Shane's estate sandwiched between a Steven Seagal movie and a Nick Cage movie.
Yeah.
don't even get a Blade Trinity showing in there. Too good.
Yeah. That'd be a nice middle ground. A movie that everyone recognizes is awful. As a dedication to the only person who thinks it's good. Yeah, that's fitting. Nice. You just put it in the will.
It was great.
All right. Anything else to say about Knives Out before we move on?
For me, it put the mystery, like murder mystery movie, into kind of my like rotation where like every so often, like it's something I might consider now to check out. Like after this, I watched The Last of Sheila, which was one of Rian Johnson's like cited influences for this one. And I like enjoyed myself to like, you know, so now when I think about like, oh, what should I watch this month or what am I looking forward to? I might throw murder mystery in there now because this movie like opened that up for me. So that's why that gave it the little bump for me in my grade was like, it's just a good watchable movie. But then what it does for the genre or what it did for me in that genre, I really appreciate it.
Would you guys rather watch this or Gone Girl? Which is overly serious.
Gone Girl. I love Gone Girl. I think it's so much fun.
Pierce?
I like Gone Girl. I don't know which one I'd rather rewatch, but...
I must be the only one who does not like Gone Girl.
I'm sure that's not true. Especially in like the time since its release, I'm sure there's plenty of people that don't like it, and it had like second and third takes, but I just think it's so much fun. It's so silly.
I don't think it's supposed to. I don't know. Yeah.
Another movie that, I don't know, we might sharply disagree on is I'm Thinking of Ending Things. This is a Netflix release from last month, directed and written by Charlie Kaufman in a way that only he can. Charlie Kaufman being the writer of great movies like Being John Malkovich and Adaptation and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and the writer and director of other movies like this one and Santa Kitty, New York and Anomalisa. Around the horn. We'll start with Pierce this time. Pierce, what do you think of I'm Thinking of Ending Things?
Well, so that's an interesting question, right? Because it's tough to separate this movie from just Kaufman as a filmmaker, right? Like, there's no way for me to think of this movie without thinking of what I know about him and the rest of his films that I do enjoy. But I think he is so ingrained in just such his own lane that... It's a weird thing to even try and compare, but I think as far as within his filmography, this lies somewhere in the middle for me where with everything he does, I kind of ultimately respect his originality and his unique view on things. But as a movie itself, I fully recognize the kind of distasteful nothingness that it presents at a lot of moments. Mm-hmm. And like kind of that, how that surrealism can be tough to swallow, and not just like, on an intellectual level, but on like a watchability level, I recognize that. But I whatever he makes, I'll watch because I find it interesting. So for me, I enjoyed it, but maybe not in the ways you're supposed to enjoy a movie. I don't know if that made sense, but.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Shane, how did you swallow I'm Thinking of Ending Things?
I was thinking about ending my life the last 30 minutes.
But is that what he wanted? Is that what
apparently?
Oh yeah, that's exactly the kind of out he would like put into a movie. Yeah, I don't think he gives a shit about critics necessarily, but
just, yeah, it feels insulting, especially when I read his interview about it. He's like, well, I just don't want to explain things. It's up to interpretation. Obviously, it's not, because there's a shit ton of references here in this movie that if you've never seen any of them, it's like this movie's, you can't understand the movie fully, and the movie's telling you you're a fucking moron.
Yeah.
You're a vapid piece of shit for watching this movie in the first place.
Yeah. If you don't know anything about David Foster Wallace or an unmarried woman or not an unmarried woman, some John Cassavetes movie they were talking about, or Oklahoma.
Or the film review lady,
Kale.
Yes, Pauline Kael. Like,
yeah. Or I didn't have the last final speech of A Beautiful Mind memorized. Like, it's just a lot. I don't know. Like, but there was a lot of really good dialogue, and it was fun for like 2/3 of the movie. And then, even if you didn't know those references, but then the back end of the movie doesn't make any goddamn sense if you don't know the rest of it. Also, dude, if you're gonna come with something experimental, you want to do some film school shit, you gotta fucking hit. It's like the last, as soon as the ballet starts dancing, like that whole thing, it's 15 minutes of the rabbits finishing the other movie that we watched.
The Favorite.
Favorite. Like the last 30 seconds of that, they was like, let's do this for 15 minutes.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much where I'm in between. I admire the balls it takes to accept all this money from Netflix and the permission to do whatever you want to do, and all that permission and all that money being given to you, even with Netflix knowing exactly what you're probably going to do with it, which is going to be very weird and very not confrontational, but like standoffish. Like we talk about Nicholas Winding Refn as a guy who really hates his audience. And I don't think Charlie Kaufman gives a shit about his audience. Like, this is just what I'm going to do. And if you get it, great. If you don't, I don't really care. Like, I did read an interview with him, and it was both more thoughtful and less thoughtful than I thought it was going to be. Like, the whole Pauline Kael movie review, where she just reads a movie review. She was given a page of dialogue, a couple pages of dialogue, memorize this movie review when you're going to talk about it in the car, with occasional interjections from Jesse Plemons. He just put that in because he likes her writing.
Yeah.
If there was anybody looking over his shoulder, they would say, are you sure you need this in the movie? Mm-hmm. Are you sure you need...
That's not even the part that bothered me. I like that part. That was like one of the parts that kind of clued me in, like, okay, he's talking. This is where I was kind of like, okay, I think he's talking to himself. Like, this is all imagined, obviously.
But, sure.
That was good, because it was obviously something.
Yeah, I'm not saying I didn't like that part either.
Yeah.
Because it was just the sheer daring of doing that.
That made so much more sense.
You're only allowed so many of those, I guess, over the course of a 2-hour and 20-minute movie.
Right.
And like the raw nugget at the core of the movie, like what's happening, what it's about, which I didn't exactly grok the first time I was going through it, where she's a figment of his imagination, or she's like filled with all of his insecurities and his longing, and he would like to have a girlfriend like this, but doesn't. And his girlfriend in his imagining is actually smarter and more articulate than he is.
Right.
Which is a funny joke.
The amount of self-loathing.
Yeah, but like that's a joke in The Office, where Dwight is an assistant manager of a motel in heaven or something like that. Like, that's the best life he can imagine for himself. And then The Office moves on. So it's just not that interesting of an idea compared to Kaufman's other movies, especially like the two that he was in charge of, Synecdoche, New York and Anomalisa. Like, I find like those, Synecdoche, New York is a really hard movie. It's probably harder than this one to like really wrap your head around. And I wouldn't claim that I understand that movie too well, but at the core of it is like, there's a very strange mental illness, and this is 2 hours with someone who is suffering from it. And it's kind of the same thing with Anomalisa, where the mental illness is that you imagine everyone to be the same person. And that's interesting. And then you find someone who is actually not the same person, and you're desperate to hold on to that individual. And then it starts to go away. And like, there's a lot of good shit there. And here it just seemed like the sad life of a sad man, which is just not enough. it's not enough for this kind of movie. This is my, as, like Pierce, you said this was like in the middle of your Kaufman filmography. This is at the bottom, and it's not even close. It's like, and I didn't so strongly dislike this movie, but like we're talking about C pluses versus stuff that is consistently in the A range. It's just way too indulgent, for me.
So I think there's a lot of, you know, a lot of thoughts I had about what you were saying, right? But like, so for me, the thing I'm fine with a movie being challenging. I think, and again, like, I don't even mean like intellectual. Like, I don't think it's like a smart or a dumb binary. Like, I think this film is challenging in like a conceptual way or like through form or whatever, right? Like you said, like it takes some time to even grasp what is this movie even trying to say, and then deciphering what it's saying to you, right? But like for me, I think the struggle here is that there's almost like the Netflix of it all is interesting, right? Because it's like Charlie Kaufman's not making this movie for anybody besides himself, and the fact that it's readily available on Netflix means that it's open to this audience that probably would never have casually watched this movie, you know, ever. So it's there's this almost this weird context around it where it's like, who is the audience of this movie and what are they seeking it out for is probably not in any way what Charlie Kaufman intended. And so it's weird to put yourself in that position, right? To say like, what did I sign up for when I started this movie is, I guess, you know, since I've seen Synecdoche, New York, and I've seen Anomalisa, I had some idea of how bizarre this might go. But as it was going, you know, it was just a bit more abstract than I think most people were prepared for. But I don't dislike that necessarily. But like you were, to get back to what you're saying, so where it ranks in my filmography, I think most people probably agree that like when he has a director with him who reins in some of these ideas and really forms a movie out of what he's trying to say, you know, like Eternal Sunshine or Being John Malkovich, like with Spike Jones or whoever it is, like I do prefer those movies for like obvious reasons. Like I do think they are just better functioning movies. But yeah,
it's like not even close. It's those three, and then Anomalisa at a level below, and then for me Synecdoche, and then this. So, and this will come up again with The Social Network. Like if you have a writer with a very specific voice, you're gonna get the strongest possible version of that if they're also directing the movie, and you might need a director to like come in and say, we're going to tone that back a little bit here. And very often, I mean, that's why The Social Network is a better movie than like Molly's Game or any random part of The Newsroom.
That's a perfect comparison. Yeah. Sorkin's is similarly like very self-indulgent, very in his own lane. But yeah, I would say like Eternal Sunshine is one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
But it's still like what he contributes, like that adaptation, Being John Malkovich, all great. And it's his unique voice, like Kaufman's unique voice, that makes those movies so stand out for me. But it does need to be reined in to a degree. Like you said, like I'm never going to watch Synecdoche, New York again. Not because I didn't think
it was neither great, am I.
But it's just like, yeah, it's just not, I don't know, it just doesn't have, the emotional resonance maybe that those other movies have or something. I don't know.
I would watch Anomalisa again, though, for that sweet, sweet puppet dong. as far as what's similar question with Knives Out, like the experience of watching this movie. Like I said, it never fully clicked for me as far as what was actually happening. I did assume the janitor was Jesse Plemons at a certain point. The presence of the parents and their acknowledgement of Lucy / whatever else she is called over the course of the movie, because her name's not her name, that kind of like disabused me of the idea that she was made up. But then maybe the parents were made up too. But ultimately, I just didn't care enough about this movie to like figure out all the answers to these questions.
The parent stuff is just, you know, just being weird for weird's sake. There's nothing of value really added to why they were so weird.
Sure.
Like, why is that mom that weird? That weird. It was unnecessary. It's just, I don't know.
Pierce.
I'm so mad at last.
Yeah, no, I do think that it's this weird thing too, where like, I don't know if y'all had this experience watching it, but I particularly liked Jessie Buckley, the female lead.
Yeah, she's on a roll.
I thought what was happening in that opening car ride was the movie I wanted to see in a lot of ways. Was like,
yeah,
he's playing with subjectivity there, where like, can he hear her thoughts, or why is he interrupting her, right? And I found, I think as the movie went on, you slowly learned that there's not much character behind her, in part because she doesn't really exist, when I would much rather have maybe seen a movie that followed that character we get to see in the first scene with her. And when that really starts to derail is at that the dinner with the parents, because like I really like Toni Collette. Double Collette, you know, movie pick this week. But I agree that those performances and that scene derail what it goes in a direction that I don't know. I was on board with the movie, and then that's where it starts to derail, I guess. But you know, I think,
and all those scenes are good is the frustrating thing too. Right. Like all the stuff with the parents, I really enjoyed. But what you figure out in the last part of the movie has to be reconciled with all the stuff that's happening there.
Yes.
Right.
It just does. I just can't mentally make it work, which again might be Charlie Kaufman, like Shane, like you were saying, like calling me a dummy. You can't figure out his little puzzle box.
Right.
Because you do kind of feel that, that voice above your head of Charlie Kaufman being like, why didn't you read Infinite Jest? Speaking of film spotting, when Synecdoche, New York came out, both of the hosts of Film Spotting loved it, and one of the co-hosts spent like 10 minutes just railing at a review that was like, I just didn't understand this movie. The director is putting all this stuff out there, and if the movie is well made and engaging, then it's worthy of your time and your mental effort. But there's thousands of movies. Like I can't just put all this energy into this one movie with its dancing and its Tulsi Town and whatever the fuck else. And just like at a certain point, I did just want to throw my hands up and be like,
Tulsi Town was actually better than the other stuff he rips off or is alluding to because it's made up. Like that, I thought it's better, it fit with the movie better than, here's this scene from Oklahoma. Here's everyone in old people makeup for whatever reason.
See, so for me though, like on the idea of like the like deciphering a movie or like a movie being a puzzle, I jokingly tweeted this, but I also kind of sincerely meant it, which is like, if Christopher Nolan watched a Charlie Kaufman movie, like I think his head would explode, you know. There's this idea now, though, in movies where we consider something like a puzzle that isn't we think it's this magic trick, but we can see the strings the whole time. And that's like Christopher Nolan movie, right? It's like he thinks he's pulling off this trick when really it's kind of right there on the surface the entire movie. But I respect that at least with this movie or other Charlie Kaufman movies that do this better, that there is some actual deciphering to be done. Rather than, you know, everything being, I don't know. I don't think it's a necessary binary between like, it's either spoon fed to you or it's a total mystery. Like, I like that there's a spectrum here that we can get a movie that does have this level of like post discussion, I guess. Like, that maybe, like, not that you necessarily have to do some homework, but that there's something to chew on once you've watched it, at least.
But you can't conclude this movie without doing the homework. Like, where is that speech from at the end? It just sounds like a sloppy speech delivered in an even more sloppy manner than it was in the movie, possibly. I don't remember. I haven't seen Beautiful Mind in a while, but...
I'm sure Charlie Kaufman does not think highly of A Beautiful Mind.
He beat out one of his films, I guess, that year.
That sounds so, right.
Adaptation, I think is what it was. Like, okay, smart guy, got it.
I mean, like, I did like his
movie you hate so much, you incorporate, you think about it so much, you put it in one of your movies. Got it.
I really laughed at his Robert Zemeckis burn. He apparently got permission for that. Yeah. So it was all above board. Yeah. But if it wasn't, so much the better, because that's a real director to director throwdown.
It feels like he actually does despise Robert Zemeckis.
He might. Yeah, he might.
Yeah.
And if you've ever seen Adaptation, he pretty much the stand-in character for him slags on every major market, big budget movie. And that's a great movie. That's that movie's about a lot. But yeah, I'm sure he thinks about that kind of stuff. I don't want to spend too much time on I'm Thinking of Ending Things, even though I'm sure we could, because we have another movie coming up that I want to spend more time on. But
John, would you say you're thinking of ending this segment?
I am, yes. But I do want to get in. There is some relatable sad man behavior in this movie. But what I found most relatable from my standpoint is just the simmering irritation that Jesse Plemons' character has towards everything his mom says and does. I don't know. I recently went home over Labor Day, and you just can't help but revert back to your teenage self. And if your teenage self fucking sucked, then a big part of that is just hating your parents so much. And I really don't like going back to that mental place. I can't help it.
It's amusing watching you with your mom.
Is it so transparent?
It's probably not to them.
I don't know. Maybe they're just super used to it. I leave every interaction like, God damn it, I don't like that person. But I can't help it.
With my dad, so I
get okay,
that.
Fair enough.
I get that.
Would you say you feel like a pig being eaten out from the inside by maggots?
Not dissimilar.
Yeah.
I feel like a dumpster full of Blizzard knockoffs.
Yeah. Do you feel like a naked old janitor freezing to death in a truck? You know?
That actually sounds okay. That seems like an okay way to go. Freeze to death in your car.
It says it in the movie, so it's probably not bad.
Yeah, of all the different ways. Something we forgot to do between Knives Out and I'm Thinking of Ending Things is play our movie game, our giant resource of our group spreadsheet. So I'm just going to, again, randomly select one of the 3,972 movies we're at the moment. I recently added another mess or so. That's how we group movies. A Murder of Crows, a mess of movies. 2501. This Means War, a romantic comedy. And I'm going to start that one off, as usual, with Chris Pine.
Okay, great. Because Chris Pine is in some movies, and he's a generic-looking guy. I cannot think of a movie he's in.
Not a single one.
Not a single one right now. Chris Pine.
Five.
He is in...
Four. Three.
Star Trek.
There you go.
All right. I don't know the difference, Jim.
Pierce, Star Trek?
Star Trek. Let's go with Zachary Quinto.
Okay. I really want to get to The Social Network, so I'm going to say We Are Who We Are. No. I'm sorry. That's not right. What the fuck is that movie called?
I was going to say.
I just watched that TV show, and this is a... God damn it. Do I have nothing for Zachary Quinto? I can't think of what that movie is called. Fuck. I'm out.
So, now I start...
Zachary Quinto.
Zachary Quinto?
Yeah. There's an obvious answer here that I'm a fucking idiot for not...
Is he in Harold and Kumar?
You think of Neil Patrick Harris?
I don't know. I don't know who Zachary Quinto is.
Okay. I mean, he's obviously in Star Trek and The Darkness.
Yeah, I was going to say
that. Does he play...
What the fuck is that movie called?
Does he play Sulu?
He plays Spock.
Yes.
No, he's Spock.
Or Spock. Okay.
Jesus, John.
I'm embarrassed. I've got it. What is this Spock, fucking movie?
Yeah. I don't remember what the guy looks like.
What is
Zachary?
What is her name?
Do you remember? He was in Heroes. He used to slice off the top of people's heads with his finger.
I never watched that show.
Yeah, it's probably for the better.
Oh, that's who this guy is. I have no idea.
Yeah, what else is he in?
Who We Are Now. That's the movie I was trying to think of. Emma Roberts is in that. Terrible round of the movie game. Good job, Pierce. You won.
Thank you.
For our final movie, we selected The Social Network, David Fincher's pretty widely recognized masterpiece about the founding of Facebook, released in 2010, around this time. A movie that has kept up a very strong legacy since its release. One of the great Oscar crimes in not awarding Fincher director or the movie itself Best Picture or the King's Speech of all fucking things.
The original story about a rich person overcoming a slight impediment.
Yes, a true tragedy. initial thoughts about The Social Network, Shane.
This was really good, and
first time you had seen it.
First time I'd seen it, I avoided all these years because I assume because Justin Timberlake was cast that it was going to be bad.
Yikes!
And even though everyone said it was good the whole time, I still didn't believe it. So I'm glad you made me watch this. This is good.
Peter, Social Network.
Yeah, so I'm on the other side of this is probably my 1,000th time watching it. I gave it an A+ because I don't think any movie's perfect. I don't abide by that. But I think this movie works on every level, where it is both watchable and rewatchable in the most the most basic sense of the term, is that it's just a great movie to turn on and sit through, and there's never a bad moment. But I also think it works on so many levels of it's Fincher operating at some of his best work. It's Sorkin being reined in to do some of his best work. All the performances hit for me. Every scene I will sit and I will finish the rest of the movie if it's on. I really love the movie. And I think for me, and I know because we're going to go here, for me, I'm able to just watch this movie as what it is. I don't judge it on accuracy or on did it predict Facebook or not properly. Like, that's not what I'm watching. I'm watching a movie that I think just tells a captivating and funny story. Ultimately, it's both of those things. It is captivating drama done on a expert writing level and expert directing, and I also find it just enjoyably funny. So I love this movie. It's one of my favorites. Top of the is number two of the decade for me, but it could easily be number one. So I'm all for The Social Network.
I have zero emotional resonance with this movie. None of it hits me at the level it makes you want to go AA+ on this at all. I have zero emotional response.
I mean, that's fair. Fincher is a very clinical, we're going to do this and this and this, A to B to C director. He's one of my absolute favorite directors. He's my second favorite Fincher after Fight Club. I'm a 20-year-old college student. We should do that movie. God, I would.
I was gonna say I've been on a Fincher binge since I watched this. I've been rewatching everything. Let's do a Fincher pod. I want to talk.
I'm in.
Yeah, not against it. We can get Shane's wrong ideas about Gone Girl.
Great.
I'm with Pierce. I think this is a fantastic era-defining movie, one of the best of the decade. A tiny downgrade from my number three, which is the list that is currently on MediaCommunity.club, to probably five or six. A couple of hanging chads that we'll talk about in the course of this segment. But I think it's just the perfect synthesis of directing and writing and score and acting and characterization, and I think it's timeless and extremely modern. I do think it has a lot to say about, not necessarily about social media necessarily, but a lot to say about economics and vision and leadership. And I feel like Chaucer or Shakespeare could have written the story. It's kind of just elemental, even though it is about something that that is very specific for the modern age. It's great, and I watched it twice in the last couple weeks, and a tiny little bit of a downgrade, sure, but it's just scene to scene, it moves so quickly, and it's very funny, and it makes you feel smarter for having watched it. Compared to I'm Thinking of Ending Things, it makes you feel dumber. So just as a piece of history, I remember very clearly when this came out, this theoretically should have been Zuckerberg's one of the best years of his life. He was named Time's Man of the Year in 2010. He gave $100 million to the New Jersey school system that I think he came from, or maybe he was just moved to give it to New Jersey specifically.
Can't think of a better place to spend all my money.
My understanding of that gift is nothing really came of it. It was kind of badly spent, and then there were no results.
It's hard to believe in New Jersey.
So he's, you know, he's at the top of his career. Facebook is a going concern. It's not a fucking cesspool yet. It doesn't have the negative news and the negative results associated with
it
at that point
yet. They hadn't been QAnon yet. They hadn't taken that stuff.
That's true. They weren't heroes just yet. But at the same time, everybody is kind of forever going to associate him with the portrayal in this movie, even though nobody involved in the making of the movie and nobody who watched the movie and did like the most minimal of research into like what's real and what's not in The Social Network would come away thinking, wow, this movie really got to the core of who Mark Zuckerberg is. Like, Mark Zuckerberg in real life had a on and off again girlfriend who he eventually married and had children with, and he's still married with today during this period of time. All of the footage from like from this period of them coming up with the website, it doesn't seem anywhere near as acrimonious. And he doesn't seem as like negative and like life sucking a presence as Jesse Eisenberg plays him. The final clubs are just a total dreamed up thing for him, which is kind of like the root interest. Like, his interest in the final clubs is an offshoot of the thing that makes him break up with the girlfriend in the first scene, and which in turn drives him to go down this path. But I don't give a shit. I wrote in my very long review that it's kind of like the horseshoe theory of movies, where it's so inaccurate it becomes accurate again.
It's so weird that so many people thought this was supposed to be accurate, because I don't remember it being marketed as accurate. And
I think it's just
nothing
assumed.
About this movie like makes you think like, oh, okay, that was such an exact thing that I don't know.
I think it's just assumed anytime a movie is made about somebody, and I don't know what the life rights like. He wouldn't have sold the Mark Zuckerberg would not have received any money in the writing process of this movie. I don't know who did exactly, if anybody did. Like, it is based on a book called The Accidental Billionaires, which takes as one of its primary sources Eduardo Saverin, who we know a lot more about in the intervening years, and he's and his behavior subsequently. And, you know, he's a guy on the out. So, like, he's essentially a disgruntled employee. So why would he have good things to say necessarily? He's going to shade it a certain way, and then the movie shades it further from there. But I don't know. Like, you can just make a movie about a famous person and have no input from them.
I would assume. Yeah. So. I mean, if it's like, so if you're using their name,
yeah,
you make a movie.
You're using their You're using their product.
You can't use their. I mean, you can't probably couldn't get away with using like a whole movie. Like the end of Tim and Eric's $1 billion movie, they have a Johnny Depp lookalike.
And it's John Depp?
John Depp. And it's obvious, okay, so using his name and likeness to make a quick parody. But if you made a whole movie about his life, I think, especially when you get stuff inaccurate, then you're putting yourself at some...
Okay, because like there were no ramifications, like legal ramifications for this movie, even though like it implies that Sean Parker was a statutory rapist and a drug addict, and it, you know, it's not a flattering portrayal of Mark Zuckerberg, but yeah, I don't think anything actually happened.
Maybe, I guess you can do it. I don't know.
What is true in the movie, and I give it a pass here because I think the person who would like create the face mash thing and have business cards that say I'm CEO bitch and just the existence of the Winklevi is like,
yeah,
people that exist in the world, it just those details among others just make all the motivations plausible, and it feels true even knowing that it all comes from the mind of Sorkin and Fincher. So Pierce, you mentioned like none of this moves the needle for you at all.
Well, I think I appreciate it on one level, but I understand the criticism on another. But like, so what I appreciate about it is like, so Sorkin does this a couple times, right? Where he basically takes these pieces and he arranges them. I don't know what the analogy is, on a chessboard, I guess. He arranges them on the chessboard the way he wants to tell what you were saying, like a Shakespearean kind of drama, right? And I find that to be a better movie than, I don't know, if he tried to tell the straight story to the to the most accurate possible way, right? Like I think the good comparison would be the Steve Jobs movie Hero versus the one starring Ashton Kutcher, you know? And it's like, I would rather watch his construction of what he believed, you know, him constructing a story that gives us the same feeling and themes of the real life events and delivers us a message that echoes what's happening in real life. I'll accept that, and I enjoy the movie more because of it. But I also, like, I don't know, it's like, is anyone in the year 2020 watching The Social Network and saying, oh yeah, that happened? I don't know. And I don't know whose responsibility that is exactly. Like, I don't know if it's the filmmaker or the writer who need to say, like, hey, by the way, everybody, this movie takes liberties with the story. Like, every movie does that, right? So,
yeah.
So I don't blame Sorkin for doing that. I think he's more successful in this movie than others doing it, because there's just something so perfectly constructed with these characters, I feel like. But it doesn't, like you said, it doesn't move the needle for me. I think, too, the conversation now in 2020 has become like, oh, Mark Zuckerberg is portrayed as an asshole in this movie, and now Facebook is this totally, like, tumultuous thing in our lives. I separate those two ideas, you know? Jesse Eisenberg never met Mark Zuckerberg. He's not a real portrayal of the character, you know? So it's like, I don't ascribe it that accuracy that maybe other people do. I don't know.
I think a lot of the arguments that the movie Zuckerberg makes are very similar, at least as far as the business is concerned, are very similar to probably what the real Mark Zuckerberg thought. And I think this is how the movie gets better for me, is knowing that the Mark Zuckerberg of the movie would hate what Facebook is now and has been for like 5 or 6 or however many years, where it's just totally larded up with ads and there are probably no more college students on it at all. And it's everybody's crazy aunt and their mom, and everybody's posting baby pictures instead of like who they're interested in fucking.
Right. It's not cool anymore, is the,
you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's the show Silicon Valley is actually what ruined my emotional response to this.
Sure.
It's the same storyline over X years.
That's a good comparison. It's the same thing with Sorkin and The West Wing, right? Like, for years, The West Wing was like, oh, this is politics. And then Veep came out and it was like, no, like, slow your roll. This is politics, you know? And this happens with Sorkin a couple times. Same thing with Studio 60, where it's like, oh, man, this is the high drama life of sketch comedy. And then 30 Rock comes out and it's like, no. This is,
yeah, we're doing Fart Doctor here.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, to go back to it, like, I think Social Network, though, is the example where it works best. And part of that is probably because it gets reined in by Fincher, who is also a, like, hyper meticulous, every single detail is considered. But I also think, like, the story fits that purpose, where, like, everything Sorkin writes has this heightened drama to it, right? Like Shakespearean, right? It's like, everything is this, everyone speaks the way Sorkin speaks. Everyone is the thoughtful, referential, you know, there's this repertoire to it, right? But in the realm of The Social Network, with the character of Zuckerberg or the Winklevosses or Eduardo in these like courtroom situations, it works, you know, it works in this. I think it works in like A Few Good Men as well, because they're in a courtroom, right? So I like it. I think it's, again, it's just almost this perfect kind of like, it's this perfect recipe that just came out right in this instance.
While we're talking about what's real and what isn't, if we could get our chief legal officer to chime in on the accuracy of the depositions, does anything get that spidey sense tingling?
I thought that, I'm trying to remember them now, but I believe if I recall it right afterwards, I said those were pretty good depositions. They're pretty accurate. Like, it's a short and truncated version of it, but I think it was like that. But I'm trying to remember. I don't recall the movie exactly. I told you it didn't resonate. The movie. It's something I admit is a good movie, but...
Something that I want to talk about over these last two viewings is... One of the handful of things that continues to stick in my craw about The Social Network is its depiction of Saverin as this like good-natured, good-intentioned guy who just is in over his head and doesn't know what he's doing, and is just not on the same page at all with the true visionary. But it doesn't judge him for that. It's just the real life again sinking into this movie where like Saverin eventually is a tax-dodging expatriate who took his settlement and ran to Singapore or something. And to hear what actually happened, where he in this period of time was like trying to start his own business off of Facebook, and he's just clearly not an invested partner. I think Andrew Garfield is great here, but the movie needs an antagonist for Zuckerberg, who, you know, functions kind of as his own antagonist. I don't know. I feel like there might have been a better way to get into it other than making him this guy who on a handful of occasions in like tossed off ways that are no doubt purposeful is like really trying to make a connection with Zuckerberg, where he is like, do you want to talk about it? I'm here for you. And that's like a total misread of who Zuckerberg is in the movie Zuckerberg anyways, that you can see what the movie is trying to do in making Saverin so sympathetic. But that guy, if you're going to tell me he's also friends with Mark, then he would know better than to make these like naked emotional plays. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I think usually where I thought you were going to go with it is that usual thing of like, how are we supposed to feel sympathetic for somebody who, you know, the simplest way of putting it, right, is like the Harvard business grad didn't read the contract, you know?
Sure, like yeah.
In criticism. But I like that in that there's something, you know, there's like a, again, to bring him up, I guess, like a Shakespearean tragic flaw in that, right? That like his hubris or his over-reliance or trust in Mark led to his own downfall, and it's his own doing that did it, you know? And so yeah. I like that aspect of his character. And I think in a lot of ways too, like you said, that Andrew Garfield's performance kind of transcends some of that, because I do think it's a really great performance. So it's like, I don't know, I think he does such a good job of playing this guy that it's similar to Ana de Armas in a way, where it's not that I feel like I have to be sympathetic to them, but their performance kind of brings it out, you know?
Yeah, and I wrote about this a lot in my review, that like all of the main characters, with the exception of the Winklevi, if they weren't portrayed as well as they are or as nuanced as they are, it would be very easy to dislike all of them, which it seems like, Shane, you very well might have. But there are certain grace notes that they're doing, or they're just putting something off that makes you, if not root for them, then at least sympathize with them. Like, I think the movie, as far as the trading away of his own stock options, like the movie considers the sin not the signing of the contract, but the contract being placed in front of him in the first place. Mm-hmm. It doesn't judge Saverin for doing that. It judges Mark for arranging this like double cross. And Garfield's like big sad eyes, and he's frequently caught in the rain, and there's a lot of ways that the movie puts its finger on the scale. And with Zuckerberg as well, just like he's got a good sad boy face in this movie that he breaks out on occasion, where he like tucks his chin in, or like his backstory about giving away this or that website or technology. There are just these little ways that the movie makes you sympathize with them as they're being extremely difficult people, especially Zuckerberg. And the outlier of that, as I said, are the Winklevi, who the movie just has nothing but contempt for, which I love, because those guys are deserving of contempt. Yes. Like, it's one thing for Saverin. Okay, fine, whatever. He put some tiny amount of money into the company at the very beginning. And great. You're owed something for that, for taking like the risk. That being said, 0.03% of Facebook is still a significant amount of money. Right. But like the Winklevi, movies that are about inventors that get screwed. I'm thinking of like Flash of Genius, like a Greg Kinnear movie about windshield wipers and how Ford or GM or whoever didn't want to pay him. It's one thing to have an idea. It's another thing to like have the wherewithal to make that idea happen. And the one thing is so much more valuable than the other thing that I just can't, it's really hard to find even
the you get a really good patent lawyer.
Exactly. Unless you can just sue the fuck out of somebody with your in-house counsel and make them pay as the cost of doing business. So there's just no way, there's no way into feeling sorry for those guys. And how the movie gets you not to like throw popcorn at the screen while you're watching them is make them really funny. Mm-hmm. In their like cluelessness and the way that they say, like the way Armie Hammer says crimson, like they're slandering us in the crimson. He says it like he's taking communion or something. It's hilarious.
I was going to say that whole, you know, kind of B plot of the movie with the Winklevi, I guess that would be the plural.
Sure.
That whole B plot though is where I think a worse movie would falter, right? Like those are the scenes that when you rewatch it, you go, oh, I could skip over those. But the strength is in the writing and in Armie Hammer's performance. Like you're saying, like those scenes are so funny, and that's where like Sorkin's kind of, you know, he's got that repertoire with the dialogue. Like those work so well that they make the movie for me like wholly watchable. Like there's not a down moment. Whereas a worse version of this movie, you know, it would drop off at moments maybe. But they really sell that. The whole everything with the Winklevi, like you're saying, so many quotable lines, obviously from the movie, but so many specifically from Armie Hammer in those scenes. So yeah, I'm right there with you.
Yeah, and like just the way that the final line for them in the movie is "Let's gut this freaking nerd," where they're just totally taking the mask off and they're the Animal House bullies that we just assumed that they were, even though they know about computers, and it's just so satisfying. Even though, sure, fine, whatever, they got paid, but that the movie can include them as like hapless bad guys who kind of win, and you don't like hold that against the movie that the bad guys like got one over on Zuckerberg.
Oh no, so it's like that makes it a better movie.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Right.
There are hours of extras on the Blu-ray, and I always tell myself I'm going to be a good physical media owner and watch all the special features that come with all the movies that are clogging up my walls.
That's, other than talking about Looper out loud, that's the second most thing you talk about.
Special features.
Special features.
And physical media.
Now I'm going to talk about Looper for the day. Let's talk about this. Have you guys checked out the special feature on Robin Hood Disney? It's actually just the book someone's reading.
Yeah, it's just the animatic, like the pencil drawing.
Yeah.
Great. Then, just learned so much about that sexy fox.
Shane, don't get stuck on the special features on the Looper DVD. Because
those are considerable. I have not watched
the CGI facial reconstruction on Joseph Gordon-Levitt to take away his eyebrows to look like Bruce Willis.
Oh, yeah. They've got the soldering of his mouthpiece.
Oh, yeah.
10 minutes on that. Solid stuff. I did watch the extras on the social network, and they are fascinating. Mm-hmm. Fincher has this kind of a bad reputation as being a director who like pushes actors away by making them, for example, like it took 99 takes to get the first scene of the movie. Jake Gyllenhaal in Zodiac, like he's never going to work with David Fincher again because he hated it. I think the same for Mark Ruffalo. Brad Pitt's worked with him several times, so he didn't seem to have a problem with it. Granted, it's like a sponsored extra on the Blu-ray, but I believe all the actors in the social network when they're like, I loved all that stuff. And you see it happening, and you see it like spliced next to each other, like different reads, and you see the value in doing that if everybody is on the same page. Like, it's one thing, I guess, to make Jake Gyllenhaal, you know, pick up a salt shaker in a diner 100 times and really break his brain. But if everybody's on board and you can see how different a scene could be just based on a different enunciation placed on a line that has been pored over long before anybody even got a camera out, with the actors, and they're like going through the script word by word. Like, is this word correct? What does this word mean? Is it in the right place? And then you finally get to filming, and then you get to the enunciations and all the different kind of stuff that you can do with this script. And it totally takes all the power away from Sorkin, who is a character I am not a fan of generally, especially when he's left to his own devices. I can't stress enough how terrible The Newsroom is. And that made me like Sorkin more, seeing him as like a neutered presence on the set. It made me like Fincher more for seeing him. And who knows? I'm sure he yelled over the course of the making of this movie, but he just seemed like a guy who knew exactly what to do and totally in charge. And it did make the movie more impressive in watching all these special features. And again, like, who knows if they're lying, but in keeping with like The Social Network itself, I'll take the fiction over the reality. And imagine that this was a great experience for all involved.
Yeah, it's one of my, it's I think it's a great companion piece to the movie itself. And what you're saying is like getting to see Fincher and Sorkin sit in a room together and pore over that first scene line by line.
Yeah.
Because Fincher's whole thing is like, he's just so meticulous with every single thing that's on screen is considered every moment. And so to see him and Sorkin figure that out together is just fascinating. And yeah, it's what you're saying, which is just like, I'm so fascinated by his process, both of their processes, but specifically Fincher's. And as a viewer, it's tough sometimes when you hear those stories. And it is like, you know, like you hear about Jake Gyllenhaal, or you hear about, or not even the people you hear about, but like you think about that crew and the people that work on a movie and everything that goes into a movie. And there's certainly terrible examples of this with filmmakers, like, you know, what Stanley Kubrick did to Shelley Duvall or whatever. Sure. But it's like, as a viewer, I don't know how, if I quarrel over that, ultimately, where does that leave me? Because the movie exists and it's, I don't know. So I ultimately, I can only take it at face value. I can only take the movie for what it is. And so for me, I find it fascinating to see the finished product in consideration of the entire process that Fincher goes through. So I of course, I recommend, it's like a 90-minute featurette that's on YouTube. And it's like you're saying, it's just a fascinating look into a very, very like meticulous process.
Yeah. Like, I came away with it thinking he's doing it correctly. And someone like Clint Eastwood, who like takes one or two shots at most, he is doing it obviously wrong.
The audience doesn't know this is the 10th time we've recorded this podcast tonight.
The other small quibble I have with the movie that I truly love and remains in my top 50 of all time, and it's not one of the A pluses, one of the 20 something A pluses, is the character, like the scene where Saffron's girlfriend lights the scarf on fire. She just becomes a crazy person in a way that I don't think is helpful towards the movie. Like, Sorkin often gets dinged for writing bad female characters. And I think the distinction between the film being misogynistic and the characters being misogynistic, if not for that one scene, would be like totally crystal clear. Like, all the main characters have low to no opinions about women, and the movie about them fits within that idea, within that feeling. But then that character of Christy just turns into an insane person. And that scene is the only one that really sticks out as far as being like unnecessary.
And the scene doesn't even bother me so much. Yeah.
She seemed cool. Like, she's cool in the dinner scene.
Yeah.
She just a totally fine
acting the whole time anyway, like, to actually like these guys.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, like, she's obsessive about the failure.
I hear what you're saying, John. I think that's a pretty common, like, that I agree is that is a knock on the movie. But even within that scene, it's still just, it's just watchable. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it looks incredible. It looks great. Just yes. The lighting and what is chosen to be the focus and what isn't. It looks fantastic. But I don't know. There must have been another way. And yeah. I get the point of the scene too, is like, this is the pivotal moment for Saverin. Like he tried this drastic move, and this is the phone call where he has to make himself heard. But in the meantime, his apartment is on fire. Mm-hmm. So he totally surrenders. But whatever, freezing the account was pretty unforgivable in the first place. Here and there, I would have rather seen the thing played straight, like Saverin at his very best and most composed going up against a furious Zuckerberg. Like, that sounds like an interesting scene, a more interesting scene than Saverin panicking. And yeah, we don't get that. He doesn't get to make his case in the most strenuous way possible, because this crazy lady is burning a scarf. But yeah, I would change that scene and really nothing else about The Social Network. Anything else about this movie before we wrap it up?
No. I think it's weird that I don't like it more than I do.
I've been seeing a lot of articles pop up, like second takes and third takes at the 10-year mark. And most of them are positive, but you know, not all of them are.
Yeah. I would say, to put it, you spoke on this earlier too, John, but like, to contextualize where I was when I first encountered this movie, I was, I think, a freshman in high school, and I distinctly remember it was a spring break, and I didn't get to go anywhere for my spring break. I was just like stuck at home. So I pirated all the Best Picture nominees or something like that. So I remember in that week, I watched like this, The Fighter, 127 Hours, A King's Speech. And I remember distinctly watching this movie, and it was like a formative moment in probably that week for me, and specifically this movie as the outlier, being like a formative moment for me in enjoying movies. So I always hold it in high regard on top of, you know, everything else I've said. So
sure, yeah. And to echo that, like I remember what general part of the theater I was in. I remember who I was sitting around when I watched this movie when it came out that first week of October. And I remember the big dumb smile on my face as you're just watching one incredible scene after another incredible scene. And like, your expectations, I mean, I'm a big Radiohead fan, yeah. And the trailer has, you know, the choral version of Creep. So you're like, you're already built up to see this movie, and then it fulfills your expectations and then some. And yeah, that's like a very special like theater going experience that I really miss and can't seem to get motivated to do anymore, but whatever. This time sucks.
Does so I guess if we're wrapping up
on yes
this, well let's don't forget we have your game and then my game.
Oh, you got
same,
your
same game.
See, that's fine because we missed a round, so perfect.
While you're looking for the movie, you want to do this one first? Or
sure, yeah. What do you got?
So these three movies, what are you gonna do? You have your choice. You can marry one, take one to Vegas for one night, and then a week long vacation with just you in that movie.
All right, clean it up.
Which one we're all marrying?
Marry one, weekend vacation, week long vacation.
Yeah,
it's just okay. I would go on a week long vacation with I'm thinking of Ending Things, because a lot of conversation to be had probably. I wouldn't necessarily get bored.
Yeah.
Knives Out's pretty cozy. We mentioned the cozy sweaters.
Yeah.
So you could just settle down with your big oversized coffee mug.
Okay.
And spend the rest of your life with Knives Out, and you have a wild time with Sean Parker in Vegas.
This is not how I thought this was gonna go. But
well, Pierce might fulfill your expectations.
You know, I'm gonna swerve. Here's what I'll say. I'm taking to Vegas The Social Network because it's a reliable bet. You know, it always pays off every time I watch it. I'm going to go on a week vacation with Knives Out. And I'm thinking of Ending Things because
Vic doesn't have a high opinion of marriage. I mean, you're turning to gibbering Toni Collette.
In maybe in our lifetime together, maybe I'll finally understand this movie.
Yeah. That is one part about marriage, I guess. Yeah. I thought you're both going to marry the Social Network, because who better to spend the rest of your life with than somebody you both consider excellent?
Not a lot of characters I'd want to spend a lot of time around in the Social Network.
I think Knives Out for the week on vacation is the correct answer, because it's fun consistently. You're nothing too stressful is going on, and you get your week. And I don't know why you don't want to go on an experimental fucked up trip to Vegas.
That's fair.
With I'm thinking of any things. You're going to do some shit in Vegas with this movie that you're not going to ever be able to talk about to anybody. You're going to feel violated.
All right. That was fun. For our last round of the movie game, we're just doing two this week. We randomly selected number 1638, which strangely enough is our 1638th ranked movie of movies that have more than three ratings.
Yeah.
Transformers: The Age of Extinction.
Jesus.
We'll start with Mark Wahlberg.
Mark Wahlberg is in Four Brothers.
Four Brothers. Well, if there's anyone besides John, I would have an easy win right here. But I know John knows another
one. I really fucked up that last round.
Okay, I'll try it. I think you're going to know one, but I'm going to go Andre 3000.
Sure, he's in Be Cool.
Ah. See, yeah. I thought you were going to go Claire Denis.
That's correct.
I thought you were going to go High Life.
Oh, that would have been, yeah. Yeah, that would have been good. John Travolta to Pierce.
Travolta?
Yeah.
What movie did you say?
I said Be Cool.
Oh, you said Be Cool. Okay, yeah. Travolta, let's say... this isn't tricky, because I have to then name another person from this movie if y'all can't, right?
That is correct.
Okay. So I'm going to say... John Travolta is the voice of the dog in a little movie called Bolt.
Fuck.
I know one other person in that movie.
Nothing. Yeah. Pierce is playing to win. I'm out. I got nothing. Just like an actress in their 20s.
I know.
Who can play Bolts.
I saw Bolt twice.
Little girl.
I'll give a slight hint. She is a pop star.
Okay. Mariah Carey.
Ding, ding, ding.
Close. It's Miley Cyrus.
Okay, I might have said like Amanda Bynes or something.
Yeah, I saw a tweet the other day where, like, Miley Cyrus is only 16 when she released this album. Like, it was mind-blowing that she had...
Her dad is Billy Ray Cyrus. Yeah, it's not that surprising.
She had literally as much money as possible to make that fucking album. That she didn't write. She just showed up and sang.
The Winklevi came up with an idea similar to Facebook at 22.
A lot of entitled white people tonight in these movies.
That'll do us for this trio of movies. Interesting, to say the least. Like, that's the common denominator up to all-timers. And then, you know, that other one. We're in the middle of transitioning from one season to the next. We just wrapped up season 7, and at the end of a season, we do the mediocrities, where we've got awards that we give to whatever movie we selected in this last season. We had a lot of great movies over the last 12 months. Black Swan, Seven Samurai, Parasite, Social Network, Irishman, Marriage Story.
Jesus.
We laid it on heavy this last year, the beach, yeah, the skulls.
Alita Battle Angel.
Alita Battle Angel. just all-timer after all-timer. Do you guys want to talk about the skulls for a little bit? I feel like I didn't get everything out of my system during that discussion. There's a lot going on in that movie. Yeah. But... I don't know. We might record another podcast to announce the winners of those. The last time I checked the results, and I'm not doing any funny business here. I always vote first, and then I'm locked in. It's great, because we had a lot of ties, because there's only so many of us
right.
that are conscious of what's happening in the Mediocre Movie Club. It's not a big number. It's easy to get to a tie. But we might return for a podcast about that and then get back to our regularly scheduled programming of, again, selecting three movies and then writing about them and then talking about them once they've all been written about. But in the meantime, you can check out one of the longest reviews I've ever written about The Social Network is currently the lead on our page at MunichMovie.club. You can find that as well as the other two movies we just talked about and many, many, many more. Like us on Facebook at Munich Movie Club, follow us on Twitter at Munich Movie Club, and that will do us for this episode. Anything you want to plug, Shane?
If you get hurt instead, George, you gave a comment.
Nice. Pierce?
I just want to urge our countless listeners to go out and vote. You know, no, I don't know. Follow my Letterboxd. that's weird.
If you have to do one of those things, yeah. Follow Pierce's Letterboxd.
P Bauer 404 probably. So yeah.
And I'm John _ Kissel at Letterboxd. And I here's a fun fact. I was recently followed and then unfollowed by a sex robot on Letterboxd. Oh, so they've infiltrated. Man. They're there. Right. So this is a big moment for Letterboxd. I feel like they finally made it. Good for Letterboxd. You're my favorite social media site. Take that, Mark Zuckerberg. Thank you for joining me tonight, guys.
Thanks, John.
Peace.
Have a good night.